And welcome back to this week's episode of the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast, sponsored as always by those rather lovely people at Natural Grower. Now, Natural Grower supply plant-based products for both organic and chemical-free gardening and your houseplants. They're absolutely crammed with certified organic growing power, and if you're looking for amazing results with all of your fruit and veg, your flower beds and houseplants, then Natural Grower's award-winning, certified, organic, peat-free compost and fertiliser are the very best you can buy. And your plants and gardens will love you for using it. All products are certified organic, they're 100% chemical-free and 100% peat-free. And those rather lovely people at Natural Grower have given me an exclusive 15% discount off all products for my listeners. Just pop MIC15 into the apply coupon field when you check out. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast. Has it stopped raining yet? If you're a UK resident, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It hasn't stopped raining since October last year. And I'm not that far from joking, it's just been continual rain, and I think we're all just a little bit brassed off with it by now. But, I believe there's good news. The forecasts do seem to indicate that we will get a decent summer. So, hang on in there everybody, it's going to happen. This week, I welcome to the podcast writer, author, lecturer, photographer, nurseryman and garden designer Adrian Bloom. Now, Adrian and his family are the owners of the beautiful Bressingham Gardens in Norfolk, which I'm sure many of you have been to. So today, Adrian tells us about his incredible family history, how the gardens at Bressingham were started, his love of conifers and heathers, and of course, how he started his own garden, Foggy Bottom, within Bressingham. Adrian talks about the garden and his new book, Foggy Bottom, A Garden to Share, as well as his next book, a book for children entitled Wow, The Future of Bressingham, Plants, Design, Colour, Photography, and as always, lots more. So, without any further ado, here is our chat. For anybody who doesn't know, could you give us a very brief potted history of your family and Bressingham?
Yes, well, I was brought up at Bressingham, but as a child, we moved around. I went to about seven schools before I was 10 years old, I think, if I remember them all. But I was born in Oakington near Cambridge, and we moved to Bressingham in 1946 as a family. My father wanted to develop the farm. He moved the nursery from Oakington here, and so we put down our so-called roots, I guess. And this was a big enough estate to satisfy the nursery side, which he developed into one of the bigger perennial nurseries, and then started a garden in 1953 to 1962, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And he travelled the country collecting perennials. So in the end, the Dell Garden, which he created, was ended up with about 4,500 different varieties of perennials. I didn't want to follow in the business initially, and went to the United States for a couple of years and bummed around over there and did different jobs. And I think it was only when I was trying to sell encyclopedias in San Francisco, I thought maybe horticulture was worth a go after all.
You weren't anyway, one of these door-to-door salesmen knocking on the door with the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah, it wasn't Britannica. It was Collier's Encyclopedia. And people had made a lot of money, but $1,000 a week was not to be sneezed at if you were really successful back in 1960. But I was not successful, but I did learn a lot, I guess. And it's learning something, even if you learn what you don't want to do, as much as what you do want to do. So I thought I would come back to England. And firstly, I had 2 years in Europe working on nurseries, and then came back in 62. The same time, my brother came back at that time, brother Rob, and he was more interested in farming. So the two of us sort of took on the business over time, and my father gradually withdrew, started collecting his steam engines, which he's also famous for. And there, well, the museum is on the site as we speak today. But my interest has always been in plants, and I got involved in the business. And it was during a good period, I suppose, when you look back, of growth in horticulture and gardening. Garden centres were just starting up. That created, from the grower's point of view, opportunity to grow things in containers for that market. The autumn season was lost largely because of the containerization of plants, and my father didn't want to face that necessarily, but I did, and I was younger at that time, and so we gradually got into particularly conifers and heathers, which was, I wanted to do something different to my father, as a lot do. And that was something he didn't know anything about. So I started collecting and also producing stuff for the nursery.
So this love of conifers, how did that start? Was there a particular conifer that you came across and thought, wow, this is something special?
No, the wild came later, actually, but much later. But the conifer interest. Firstly, I worked at Friekaerts Nursery in Switzerland, which is mostly grows perennials, but they did grow some conifers too. And I started getting more interested in them. And then my father, I asked him if he would collect a few conifers for stock plants. And he had a few in the Dill garden. But like many plant areas, you start to look into it, you learn more, and you want to learn more, and it becomes a bit of a fetish almost to get as many as you can, but also to get ahead of what I saw as a market opportunity in growing these plants ready for garden centres and the burgeoning suburban garden where they had a bit more space.
Because am I right in saying in those heady days of the 60s and 70s, conifers were almost 50% of your business?
Yeah, they did get to that size, and obviously I promoted them. And when we went to Chelsea Flower Show, we had two exhibits for a number of years before we combined the exhibit. So we had a conifer exhibit, and also we had perennial exhibit. But eventually, I tried to show how you could use perennials in amongst shrubs and other plants. We started growing shrubs as well, so it became a much broader range altogether, and that's what I also did in my own garden. I started my own garden in 1966, and I missed the World Cup when I was into football, and I was helping on the roof put the tiles on, and thought, well, I'll catch up with that, and surely we're going to win again, but we haven't, of course. We're still waiting for that win after 1966.
Not so
But it's
good.
a memorable date, anyway.
So conifers today, I mean, of course we have to talk about the L word, the Leylandii, and out of that sort of popularity of conifers came that. But how do conifers sit with you now? Obviously they're a part of the garden, an important part of the garden. Do you still have that passion and love for conifers, or have you sort of moved on?
Well, I still have the passion in some respects, but I've moved on in so far as the garden is concerned, and anything new I'm interested in almost, or anything I haven't got, will it fit in my own garden? And I'm sort of got a lot of trees in there, interesting trees and shrubs, which are really flowering their heads off now, some of the cornice and rhododendrons and things, which I'm able to grow. Conifers, I had a vast collection at one time, but of course they do outgrow their welcome in sometimes, and they grow too close to each other. Some get disease and so on. So I've gradually thinned those out over the years, but I'm still have an eye open if there's something really attractive, and I will fit it in somewhere.
What was the last conifer you acquired?
Well, I was looking at it yesterday. There's a couple of conifer, well, call them conifer nuts, I suppose. A couple of people from Welland who came up and were interested to see some of the conifers, and they could hardly believe how big some of these things get. And of course, I've had some of these plants for a number of years. I suppose the last conifer I got was a Pinus. I don't think I can even think of the name of it, but parviflora type, very compact one with pinkish shoots. And that's now 18 inches high and is about 10 years old. So that's a truly dwarf one. Others that claimed, and this was something we tried to tell people about, you try to give a 10-year average. If you gave them an ultimate average growth like Elwood Eye, for instance, which was a very popular conifer at the time, it eventually ends up at something like 30 feet. Well, if people knew that, they wouldn't buy it. But if you give a 10-year age, it's sort of as long as most people will think ahead, and 10-year age might be 6 or 8 feet. But of course, if a conifer grows for 150 years, it's going to keep growing.
I remember those days of buying dwarf conifers. I was a big fan myself, but as you say, 10 years was that initial time frame to keep it fairly compact. But then after that, once it got its roots down, up it would go.
It would, and grafted forms, which often would be dwarf for a number of years, when the graft got its energy fully, that's the ceiling at the base of the plant, which you graft the type of plant you want off it on it, like a Picea pungens, hoopsi or something like that, onto a Picea pungens or some other form, Picea. Norway spruce on something like that, you would get a sort of a surge of energy from that bigger tree, and it would take over the plant after a number of years.
Tell us about Bressingham. I'm very interested to know. I'm going to go right down to the basics. What's the soil like? It was farmland originally, wasn't it?
Yes, and didn't help my brother and myself when my father said, "Well, if I really wanted to have a nursery, I wouldn't have moved to Bressingham." That didn't help us very much, frankly. And it has variable soil, which is good to some extent, but it's not good nursery land. And the lower land floods, particularly more in recent years in winter. So we've had crops on those lands and lost them completely. Now we don't even use, there's 120 acres of land that floods or will be open to floods, and that's not ideal. Some of the other land is sort of sandy, but it also has some clay in it as well, and the clay is too heavy, the sand is too well drained. And then you get into a more medium sandy, good, where the Dell Garden is placed. Fairly good level of soil there. That's slightly more sandy loam. Then it gets a bit heavier as you get higher in the valley. And when I talk of a valley, it's a Norfolk valley, so it's not very high. It's probably about 40, 50 feet from the top to the bottom. But nonetheless, it's a valley. And the River Waveney is the bottom of our property. Suffolk is just across the way. So you have to have a passport ready, if you go to. But yeah, so and Bressingham is a spread out village as such, but I think it doesn't really explain the detail of the soil, but I think you could say, you create microclimates partly through the soil and partly through the positioning of plants that you use. So Foggy Bottom has a wide range of soil within the hole. It's largely acid, so I can grow most rhododendrons, acid-loving plants, which is good, but we're also in a frost pocket. So, you'll always get gardeners complaining about their conditions, and it's right finding the right things really that will do well in them.
Well, it's always good to hear that, because Bressingham is a beautiful garden. It's extremely popular. And I think you look at images in books or you visit the garden and think, wow, this is incredible. But then you hear from yourself about the challenges, the frost pockets, the different types of soil, the clay, the heavy clay, the free draining sandy soil. But we still all have to work around that to build the gardens and optimize their capabilities and how they look.
You really do. And of course, the smaller the garden, the more important that is. You know, I think it's difficult with people with smaller gardens. Of course, people that had suburban gardens, I'm afraid that some of the conifers and some of the trees, you wouldn't grow a tree in a small garden. And if you look in our suburban areas, we'd be rather less likely to have any trees than maybe they would abroad. I think they've been able to use trees more imaginatively and with more ability than perhaps we have ourselves. We've sort of stuffed them with certain things. They've got too big and we've semi-given up. But what we've got left with is root run, shade, and a lot of difficult areas to grow things. So you almost need to start from scratch. But then you need to get in a tree surgeon or a tree. And nobody likes to cut anything down. So I think we're in a bit of a quandary, and I think today's gardeners, they're looking more outside the garden at the wild garden, rewilding. Mm. How do you rewild a small suburban garden? Not practical, really.
You mentioned Foggy Bottom then. Let's hear about the story of Foggy Bottom. And first and foremost, tell us how the name came about. I think that was in 1959, 1960, you came across a Foggy Bottom.
Yes. It was in 1960. I was working in Maryland in the USA and on a nursery, and we used to deliver plants down to Washington, D.C. And anybody from that area will know Foggy Bottom. It was an area which is where the Pentagon is, I think, and so on. So sometimes if I'm in America and I'm feeling brave enough, I sort of say, well, there's a lot of hot air coming up from there. So it gets very foggy, but I have to be careful. Nonetheless, it is a place, and if anybody is interested to look it up on a website, they'll see Foggy Bottom comes up. So that stuck with me. And when I got back and we started our own garden, I thought, well, since it does get misty and foggy down here as well, maybe it would be a good idea to call it Foggy Bottom. So that's where the name came from.
And the garden itself, why did you want to create this garden? What was the desire to create your own garden there?
Well, I think it was two things, one of which was that I was always aware I never knew enough about plants, and particularly about conifers and heathers and so on. And my father had used, well, he knew about perennials before he created the garden, but I was a bit impatient. So, and we had a biggish business. And so I wanted to really get the experience of growing many of these conifers and heathers that we were going to sell. So that was the main reason. And I started with a small garden. It was less than an acre within the grounds adjacent to my father's garden. And when I got married, we put up a house, which is shown in the book, in 1966. And I had a 6-acre garden in front of the house. Initially, I didn't think of more than an acre or two. But as things began to grow, I sort of looked over the fence and we negotiated a long-term objective of filling it with the plants that I wanted. So I did design the garden from there on to have big pathways, vistas, as well as intense planting. And so there's something of interest grew in the garden. But of course, it's been a learning curve, a long learning curve.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted this garden to look like when it was completed? Or was it just a continual, I mean, we all go out into our gardens, and we maybe have a sort of an initial plan, and then it just changes gradually. Yeah. Did you have was there a grand plan?
Well, I think I didn't see exactly what it would like, because it was going to be full of plants, and I wasn't thinking of any other structures beyond plants. So and not having perhaps seen a lot of the material a lot of the plants would grow to, it's difficult to say. But I did have that view about long vistas and pathways and something in the distance and then repetition of certain plants, so that there was always something of interest. And initially, it was a question of creating a garden that you couldn't see at all when you arrived. You wanted to get around the corner and see what was the other side. Now I'm more interested to lift the canopy and let people look through and glimpse a bit of it and still want to go around. They can't go through, or at least I hope they can't go through. So it's really making the most out of plants. And if a plant is known for its bark or for its foliage or for its flower, it's positioning that so you get something of interest at different times of the year. And so it has been, you know, a wonderful opportunity that I've had to do that, and still as interested as ever.
So when you first had this idea and you went to your family and said, look, this is what I want to do, what was the reaction from your family at that time?
Well, I think the rest of the family wasn't too much. You know, I was by this time joint managing director, I suppose, with my brother, who lived off the property. My father was so involved with the seam side and the gardens that he didn't see a problem, and he was quite pleased to have me there looking after the main business with my brother. So I didn't get a lot of argument, really, which was encouraging. I got a lot of questions at that point, but not arguments as to why I shouldn't do it.
And you talked about needing to learn. Were there, I mean, I guess there were mistakes. We all make mistakes, no matter how good we think we are. Any sort of standout mistakes, things that didn't work as you'd hoped they would do, plants that failed?
Certainly plants that failed. There were certainly some. I always knew the Lelandii, for instance, grew very quickly, and I planted a few of those for windbreaks around the edge of the garden, and that soon showed itself to be just too quick growing, taking up too much space. So eventually we cut them all down. I have a golden foliage form which we introduced and promoted a bit, called Golconda, which is still pretty good, but it's about 50, 60 feet high now. So I left that one, but the rest of them we cut down, particularly around the other garden I did, Adrian's Wood, where it had Lelandii among redwoods that I planted, and we had to cut those down as well.
And of course, you dedicated a wood to your late wife.
Yes, that Rosemary's Wood. Well, her favourite part of the garden was down near the pond, the other side of the pond, where we had a sort of bluebells and various other things. And she used to like the spring particularly. So it so happened that she died, or coming to rather quick period in April and May in about 10 years ago, actually. Well, exactly 10 years ago. So that was a garden that we developed really as Rosemary's Wood. And the bluebells that were planted at that time make a wonderful show, and are showed in the book as well.
And of course, you have the beautiful spire, Rosemary's Spire.
Yeah. Well, Matt, my middle son, ended up as a timber framer, and he made that as a, I don't know what you call it, it's certainly not a statue, but a monument. It's not really a monument, not big enough to perhaps have that term. But it's very, very nice, and it fits within the woodland area. And he also built the summer house and the tree house, and we're now working on, well, he's working on it, trying to put the roof on to a Japanese building. So that's in waiting at the moment. Get that finished so we can get the Japanese garden done.
Let's talk about the book. Obviously, with the history of your family and the history of the gardens, were you aware when you started this project that there would be a need perhaps to document and then perhaps have a book at the end of it? Were you mindful of that, or is that something that has happened after the event?
I didn't think about it to start with. What I'd always done and continue to do was to take photographs. And as we all know, 35 millimeter, where you put in a film, you were restrictive in the number of photographs you took. But
You remember the
nonetheless,
days.
yeah, I did take a lot, and many of those are reproduced in the story of the garden, development of the garden, once they have been digitized, and they come out rather better than I thought they would. But so I always took photographs, so it's good to have color photographs right from the beginning of the garden in 66 all the way through different developments. And then in recent years, what I wanted to get over to people, and two-thirds of the book is really about what the garden represents today and what one should look at in the way of plants, whether it be foliage, whether it be bark, whether it be the leaves or the flowers, and how you combine those and how you try and create a year-round garden. So I think with every picture, there's a caption telling about why I did this or what effect this has. Getting up early in the morning, obviously, to enjoy the best of the garden, in the evening, which is one of the best times to see the garden as well. So it's really trying to, if you like, show what I've thought and what I think about gardening and plants and so on, and pass it on, I guess.
And how did you find the writing process when you first started? You had that blank page or blank screen. Did you have an idea of what you wanted to include in the book, or was that fairly organic as well?
In a way, it was organic. I had several goes at it, but I have written several books before. In fact, the first book I wrote was on conifers back in 1972. I'd written about 10 books, but this one was going to be different. It took me about 5 years to do it, mainly because for the first 2 years, I had to go through 30,000 transparencies and sort out 2,000 that I would take from. That was a big job. I've now got a library of 130,000 digital images, plus two, well, plus the 30,000 I've mostly got. Couldn't bear to chuck anything away. Yes, it was a learning curve, and you relearn again when you look back and you see how things have developed and how big they've got and so on. And it's a lifetime experience, and in a way, somebody could take, if they bought the book and look at it, they can take a shortcut and learn about how things go and get, and what you have to do in the meantime, and quite a lot of plants too.
Well, I have to say, you very kindly sent me a copy of the book, and working my way through it, you are just immersed. It's as good as visiting the garden. I mean, not as good as visiting the garden, of course, but if people want to get hold of a copy of this book, where do they go to?
Well, I hoped you might be coming to that question.
Oh, yes.
Yes, anyway, people can buy it, but we haven't distributed it through bookshops or Amazon for that matter. We've made it available if they look on our email. I've got an email address at www.foggybottomgarden.co.uk. And that's really where we sell it. And if somebody wants to go to that website, they'll see an order form on there. I think postage is included, and it's quite a heavy book, so
It
postage
is.
is
It's a
included.
weighty tome, which I
It
have here
is.
in front of me, but it's packed with fantastic images, the wording, your words to describe how the garden came about. It's really a fascinating read, and thank you so much. I'm halfway through. You just keep turning the pages, but it's just like being immersed in the garden.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, there's a lot you can do these days, and I'd like to bring it to life for more people in some respects. Because, as you say, it is and has the development, but also the present of the garden, and some of the pictures are atmospheric, and being in the right place at the right time matters a lot with photography. And I sometimes look out of the window and I see, oh, I must get that, and get that the light just on something. And I hope I have time to write several more books.
Well, just before we started recording, you're working on a project at the moment. Are you able to tell us anything about that, your next book?
Well, the next book is actually, it's finished, and it's a children's book, and it's called Wow, WOW, which is an oft-used word, but it's a wow book because of various reasons. It's set in the initially set in the high Sierras in California, and it's about the Redwoods and how they came to Britain, and one or two unusual things about squirrels, which tell the story, if you like, of how all that happened. So it's a children's story, I would say, from ages 10 to 14. So we're just at the moment putting it together. I'll get some copies printed. I'll make sure you get one. But it's making people aware of nature and plants from other countries and various things like that. And there's a lot of factual things in it, which people are 2,000 years ago, the Romans were still in power and came to Britain, etc. These trees, one single tree is still growing, that was growing then, and a reasonable tree size at that time too. So it's a wonderful world in that respect.
So in terms of this next book for children, and talking about children, the next generation, I wondered, what are the plans for the garden? You have three sons, I believe?
Yeah, three sons. Two are in the business. Jason is running the nursery, which we have a nursery, which we sell mostly perennials and, well, mostly perennials and grasses. But and Matt is looking after the sort of, we have weddings and events. We have holiday lets at Bressingham Hall, so people can look online at bressinghamgardens.com. And they can see what we have on offer there. So it's a sort of multi-business type of business, but it's a family business, and we're all working together. They won't let me retire. I keep saying it's about time I retire.
Would you want to retire, though? Would you? Could you ever
imagine? I'd like to retire to do a bit more of something else, which, i.e., is more, well, not that much more gardening, but passing on some of the things maybe I've learned over the years, and that's with all those transparencies and all of those things. You know, we're coming up for the 100th anniversary of Blooms of Bressingham, which is Blooms Nurseries Limited, which is our family company, and in 2026. So I've got a book on new plants I want to do on that, and that will take at least a year, 18 months to do, so I've got to get on with that.
So, well, you're one busy guy.
Yeah. Well, it's great to be able to do these things, and luckily I'm in reasonable health, and still enjoying various things, and hopefully continue to do that and pass some of these things on.
You've spent a lifetime in the garden, and I wondered, what does a garden mean to you now?
Well, I think it means more than it ever did in some ways. And I'm also lucky enough to have developed a garden around the house. So I'm really have looked at getting views from every single window, all the way around the house, particularly the front where I'm more likely to spend more time. And I look at the views and I adjust the planting according to getting a view from the house. The area around the house is not open to the public. And our tree house is not open to the public, which would have some safety issues anyway. But the tree house is where you get a good view of the garden. And of course, a lot of people do come into the garden and they'd like to go up the tree house. But that's, you have to get used to disappointments in life. And that's one. Hopefully the garden makes up enough for that in some respects. And we do get some very good comments. We even get an occasional wow, which is one of the reasons for calling this a wow book. But I do enjoy gardening, and I think I'm more inclined to see the nuance and the value in plants, even though they may be rather lowly in stature or not particularly interesting, not impactful necessarily, but plants for ground cover, I think, have a useful plant. But, there's a lot of thugs around, and you've got to be careful not to plant the thugs up.
Oh, there definitely are. And those are the things we sometimes learn by mistake. You put something in, and before you know it, it's running through the garden.
Yeah, difficult. And something that initially is a good plant becomes not a good plant because it takes over, and a bit like weeds, and that's something we have to watch out for.
You sent me a picture yesterday of a stunning tree peony in your garden. The lighting behind it is just perfect. And you talked earlier about taking pictures. The plants still grab your attention. You're still there taking pictures and loving every minute of it from the sounds of it.
Yes, I have a bit of a job not to go out and take pictures at times, and I record the garden and the seasons. And of course, it's a fairly heavy tripod that I take around, which will get too heavy eventually. But something like this tree peony, I've got them originally from Japan itself, and they've done well. I moved them around. I say done well. They've survived. But they're plants that not everybody can grow or would want to grow, because then they're spectacular when they come into flower, but the flowers are so heavy that the plants droop and fall down. So if you look at the plant, you wouldn't be very impressed. But looking at that flower, one had actually broken off, one stem had broken off, because the flower was too heavy. So I brought it in, cut it, and put it in a jar, and it flowered better inside. And there wasn't any drizzle, rain, or wind, so I took those photographs inside. And cut flowers, another aspect, of course, of plants that you can have in your garden. But so that's a tree peony. I wouldn't recommend it, but at the right time, it's absolutely spectacular. As you say, when you look at that, it sort of tends to move you a bit because it's so beautiful.
It's refreshing. I've been out in the garden before chatting to you this morning. Camassias are looking stunning, and in certain lights, you take a picture. The next day, you see them again. You take another picture, and you
Yeah.
look at your pictures, and you just think, "My goodness me, I've got about 100 pictures of these camassias," but each one is exquisite in its own right.
Absolutely, and I think photography to me has brought a lot of interest in gardening, because you can walk past the garden, but the camera makes you look at it, and it makes you nowadays you can take stuff and send them to your friends or anybody, or just for yourself and have them at as a sort of library. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. I mean, some of the cameras you get close-ups of things, which I send you, was from a phone picture, and they're really good. So I would certainly encourage a lot of people to consider taking more photographs, particularly of close-ups of plants, and enjoying them later. That's where camera really works. And if you look, go through the seasons and you see the autumn and the leaf color, you want to retain that, because you can't really remember how good it was, and you can't tell somebody how good it was until you prove it with a photograph.
And of course, as we both know, as we all know, nothing actually beats being in front of the plant, because sometimes the camera can capture it quite well, but it's still not. There's that something extra outside of a picture that you actually have to be there to soak
Yes,
in the moment.
absolutely. I was there. But I mean, if you take the front cover of the book, I mean, that was which was taken, a lot of people wouldn't recognize that, was taken at 6 o'clock in the morning. And that was with the dew on this plant, Stipa tenuissima. It just sort of made it look like waves. And being there and seeing that, you could hardly believe it. You had to take, of course, you were there with the camera, but you had to take a photograph. And it's not been as good as that since, hardly. That doesn't mean to say it won't be like that, but we've had floods down that part of the garden, so some of the plants have not liked that very much. And so you've got to record the garden and plants.
Adrian, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. So let me just give a shout out for the book again, Foggy Bottom, A Garden to Share, available from your website. I will put a link into the show notes, the podcast notes. Thank you for taking the time out to come and have a chat with me today. And hopefully we can chat again when your next book comes out. Wow.
Okay. Okay, Mike. Well, thank you. And come up if you're ever up this way, you're very welcome.
Well, I think the thing is sending me the book, it's such an invitation, because you look at the book and think, I definitely need to go. So I will see you sometime very, very soon, hopefully this year.
Yeah, glad to see it. Glad to hear that. Okay, many thanks.
One of the things I love most about doing the podcast is getting an opportunity to talk to all manner of people within this multifaceted business. But generally, what it all boils down to is our shared love of plants. So today, my thanks to Adrian for allowing me to indulge in some fascinating plant talk with him. Now, to recap, Adrian's new book, Foggy Bottom, A Garden to Share, is available directly from his website, www.foggybottomgarden.co.uk. And what a fascinating book it is. And of course, it is crammed to bursting with Adrian's incredible photographs. And of course, if you're in the area, the best thing you could possibly do is go and see the stunning gardens. As always, my thanks to all of you for listening and your lovely reviews. And please don't forget to follow and subscribe. And talking of reviews, if you are able to leave a review, that would be wonderful. Now, before I go, as you probably know, I have my own regular column in Amateur Gardening Magazine, and I also have my own page within Substack, a writing page, where I write at length about all things gardening and more. And there you can find me on Substack as Mike the Gardener, Rambling Prose. And now I'm heading off into my own slightly smaller garden to sow some seeds and plant a few new acquisitions. Thanks to Adrian once again, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.